Hello, Year 11s. This is Miss Meeks and Mr. Porter, and we're going to be talking today about The Charge of the Light Brigade. So that's one of your poems for your power and conflict cluster, which you will be examined on for your literature paper two. And if this poem comes up, you will obviously have to compare it with another poem with similar themes and ideas. So we'll probably talk about some good ones that go with it as well. Okay, do you just want to start off by telling us a bit about the poem?
Certainly. So this is actually one of the easier poems in the clusters, particularly when we're looking at the war kind of areas of conflict specifically. And that's because it's all fairly literal. It's about a specific conflict that did occur in 1854. Yeah. It tells us the story of precisely what happened, and really you need to know very little about the context behind it. But it was actually written by Tennyson after he read an editorial in the Times, an account of the battle itself. And the battle was really notable and quite a famous one, the Battle of Balaclava in the Crimean War, because the orders given to the soldiers were misinterpreted. They were really badly written. They effectively said, charge for the guns. And there were a lot of guns around. And rather than actually attack the artillery section they were supposed to be attacking, they actually charged the main Russian forces. And it led to the death of a serious injury of around two-thirds of them, about 400 of the 600 men.
So what do you think that sort of, what's that telling us about the idea of power then when it comes to war, and why is that significant?
Well, there is a little bit of discussion about precisely how war is presented within this poem, what Tennyson hoped to achieve by it. I would certainly say that it's definitely not an attack on those in power, on the institutions. It's not a protest poem by any stretch of the imagination, especially when compared to some other poems in the cluster. But it tends to lean more towards a kind of glorification of war. However, it does at times criticise those in command. It does make reference to the fact that, you know, mistakes were made and that it was tragic, but it doesn't hold back from celebrating those individual soldiers and their sacrifice.
Yeah. Okay, so what would you say were like the main themes and ideas in this poem?
Certainly in regards to patriotism.
Yeah.
So these are people fighting for their country and doing it with complete commitment. They don't...
What could we like compare that to? What other ones would you say are like that, do you think?
Actually, within the war cluster, they tend to be more critical. Which one would you compare it to?
I don't know. I think maybe... Well, I think if it was a question on patriotism, I think maybe Kamikaze would be quite good, because we've got then the opposite, where we've got someone who, rather than just riding into the valley of death, to take a quote, but actually turns away from it. So I think that would be a nice one if that was the theme that you were told to write about in the exam.
I agree, and I think in general, whenever we're talking about the themes, this poem always serves as a good counterpoint, always a good juxtaposition, always the alternative. So there's lots of differences to be found in regards to the themes of this poem to the others.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think depending on which theme you're obviously asked about, there are a few really obvious choices. You know, anything particularly to do with war, you're not going to want to compare this to the Prelude, it's important to think. But I think you know, the idea of being patriotic and doing something for your country runs through like a number of the poems in our cluster. What sort of other themes are there?
Well, certainly there's the direct theme of a conflict, and specifically violent conflict, so that of war. So obviously that's open for comparison with a number of the different poems. And specifically they're talking about the nature of that war, what the experience is like. And I think that's a really interesting notion behind this particular poem. Tennyson, like I've already mentioned, wrote this poem in response to something he read in a newspaper. He was not there. He did not experience war firsthand. He also, in 1854, came from a time period in which he would not have got daily updates and photographs and video and first-hand accounts of those people suffering and dying in the war. Therefore, I think that distance enabled him to really push home that glorification of war, that notion of patriotism, the notion of the warrior hero is absent in a lot of those more first-hand accounts.
Yeah, no, when you think of something like Remains or War Photographer, you have such a different view what's going on and that soldier's experience.
Absolutely.
And I think obviously those poems, they are the aftermath, the you know, once the glory fades, what's left, well, what remains from what's going on in these battle situations. So I think it definitely is notable that it's written by someone that is not giving a first-hand account of what happened. The way that sort of war is described here, there's some important quotes that I think, if you get this poem or if you don't get this poem, and you use to compare it. I mean, some really sort of standout: valley of death, jaws of death, mouth of hell. Very like extreme, very dramatic, don't you think?
And also religious.
Yeah.
I think the idea of that kind of religious allusions, which do take place, link very closely to the notion of patriotism. This
yes.
is for king and country and God, who is on their side. And the valley of death that you just mentioned is, of course, part of the Lord's Prayer. It's a reference to the Lord's Prayer. Not only is it a fantastic imagery, but it actually has that religious sort of importance.
And I think the idea that these soldiers are, you know, that die whilst they are going into the jaws of death, that, you know, that it is almost they are probably being welcomed for their job and their commitment to their country and to some, you know, heaven, or essentially.
Absolutely. And I think that the line "all the world wondered," which is repeated two times within the poem also, that alongside the religious allusion, alongside the general theme of patriotism, really gives the sense that of this British Empire, which was obviously still very important at this time, you know, of Britain ruling the world. And this is very much the attitude with which it's written.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, you can tell that it's not one of the more contemporary poems as well, because that attitude is so present. And that, you know, like you said, for king and country, you know, we don't necessarily have that same ideas now when we think about war. We're not thinking we're doing it for Queen Elizabeth in as much the same way that you did back then, where it was almost just that sort of blind commitment to those in power.
Exactly. I actually was making a comparison with this with one of my classes today. The little sort of triplet taking place during stanza two, theirs not to make reply, as in there isn't a place to answer back.
Yeah.
They are soldiers. Theirs not to reason why, again, to question the commands they're given. Theirs but to do and die. And I think that closer to, as you move to the 20th century and the Great War, World War One and World War Two, that almost gets corrupted into "I was just following orders,"
yes.
which of course was one of the defences used by some German soldiers within World War II for the Holocaust. And that notion of, like you said, of blind discipline, of blind commitment and following orders to the letter without question, is something that we don't tend to glorify much nowadays.
No.
With our kind of focus on individuality, etc.
Yeah, having your own independence, mm-hmm. your own autonomy.
But at the time, he makes it very clear that is something to be honoured. That is something to be really celebrated, their absolute commitment.
I find that those three lines really sad.
I do.
Yeah, that's actually, I think, one of the most touching moments, that because you've got the rhyme in there as well, which makes it almost haunting, because it seems, you know, rhyme is often used, rhyme sort of normally makes something quite lighthearted, mm-hmm. But you know, that "theirs but to do and die" just also kind of shows how perhaps, like, you know, disposable
absolutely
soldiers were back then. You know, there was that lack of identity of the soldier, and as well, I think, comes through there.
That's interesting, actually, because of course immediately following "theirs but to do and die" is again that refrain, "into the valley of death rose the 600 and it's repeating the notion that despite this absolute or near certain death, they continue to ride forward. And just like you said, the kind of disposable nature of the soldiers, the fact they're not seen as individuals, is actually highlighted in his reference to them. Rode the 600.
Yes.
Not the 600 men,
no.
Not 600 individuals, but the Light Brigade, them as a single force, them as a team, as a brigade. They have a single identity.
Well, that's the 600 that we're referring to. That concludes every single stanza of the poem.
Absolutely.
That unity, that you know, so it's almost reflected in the structure that they are this this group, that, you know, this brigade, you know, whether it's road, and then not the 600, left the 600, and finally our concluding sentence of the poem, noble 600, with that sort of exclamation mark there. And that's really where we see Tennyson's opinion of them, and that's where we get, because at times it's difficult to tell if he's being critical or not. Mm-hmm. I think it takes a few, it's the first year I've taught this poem, it takes a few readings to really kind of understand, but that noble 600 is so strong. So yeah, he's not blaming them.
No, absolutely not. I think this is hugely celebratory about the about those soldiers, as individuals, but also as that group. And I think there's only really two instances that we can really draw upon within this poem in regards to criticizing authority.
Yeah.
And the first of them actually sits in the first stanza, and it's when they receive their orders. Yeah. Ford, the light brigade, charge for the guns, he said. Now, he is, of course, not specified, but we actually know from the context that this is actually one of those commanders, and those orders they received were ambiguous.
Yes.
Charge for the guns. The fact is, the mistake that was made was charging effectively for the wrong guns. And therefore, that's why this tragedy took place. So there's a slight inherent criticism there from the ambiguity of the order. But then, more importantly, is in stanza two. Not that the soldier knew someone had blundered.
Yeah.
Now, that word blunder is fascinating, because it's a, you know, it's a blunder if you accidentally trip over. You know, it's a mistake, but rather one that's consequence-free. But
yeah,
the word blunder, therefore, does not match the scale of this absolute tragedy, these kind of 400 men, which were...
It's really clever how that's been done, I think.
Correct. A deliberate understatement.
Yeah, which just... further emphasises, and I think that's where we see the criticism, that there hasn't been that careful consideration of choices have consequences, things that we say have consequences, and actually that word, that blundered, is such an important one if you're going to try and remember something from this poem. I think, you know, as you said, a blunder isn't crashing a car. You know, it is something minor. It is forgetting to tick the, you know, the box when you've done your data entry. That's a blunder. That's a teacher reference. That's not something that is, you know, essentially caused this awful tragedy.
And I think that's why this, it certainly isn't a protest poem, but that criticism is still underpinning
it. Yeah, it's there. It's definitely there.
But I think it almost potentially more effective than if this had been six stanzas attacking
a rant,
the institution,
you know,
establishment. This is actually, his primary focus is the celebration of those individuals.
Yeah, I agree. And that's where you can then sort of compare it to some of the other poems. What other ones would you say would be a good comparison for here? Bayonet charge?
Absolutely.
You know, where we've got someone who's in the war, who's terrified of the war.
I mean,
a lot more individual approach. But I think there's so many that you could use for Charge of the Light Brigade.
How about poppies?
You know what? I was thinking of poppies earlier when we were... talking about the idea of being patriotic, mm-hmm. and the kind of enthusiasm of the young soldier.
Absolutely.
To run off to war, and you know, his mother's obviously there, and Poppy's remembering and, you know, reflecting on his, obviously he's died in the war, in the same way that we've got an individual, someone reflecting on the death from the role of the mother, mm-hmm. Compared to here where we've got obviously 600 have died.
I think these two poems, Charge of the Brigade and Poppies, really actually track those changing attitudes to warfare from this kind of golden British Empire era, where all of these wars were far-flung countries, you know, quite exotic places sometimes. And the men who died, of course, and medical care wasn't even that great back then, so if you were injured, typically you died.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have those reminders about those injured soldiers. Nothing like the First World War, when you've got people coming back with horrible respiratory conditions after...
Yeah.
Being hit by gas, missing limbs,
or
shell shock.
We had photographs, which we just,
exactly.
You know,
yeah.
So it's something as basic as that. When we think now of, you know, the how communication is just so accessible. Something happens and we're watching it live on TV.
That's right.
You know, so it's just a completely different world.
Should we have a little look through it stanza by stanza so we have an opportunity to mention structure? We have,
absolutely,
of course, alluded to a few of the quotes so far, so we won't go over them in too much detail. But right from the very beginning, we've got this phrase, half a league, half a league, half a league onward. Now, a league, for those of you who don't know, approximately 3 miles. So what we're talking about is a unit of distance here. And we've got repetition.
Yeah.
And what that does?
Well, we've also got rhythm with this half,
absolutely,
a league as well, from that repetition. And I think we get that pace set from the get-go. And it's very much like the hooves of horses, I think.
Definitely.
And that kind of, that actual, we've got the sound, we've got that sensory representation of those hooves going as they charge forward, you know, these distances.
And that diameter, 2 beats per line, effectively continues.
Getting technical there, Mr. Porter.
This is where the marks come.
Yeah.
is effectively continues throughout the poem.
Yeah.
So this constant kind of reminder, this very, very strong rhythm is central to it. In fact, Tennyson actually wrote this poem aloud, speaking aloud to himself before,
oh, really,
writing it down. He went for a walk. Effectively, and that's why I think that it actually does sound like,
oh,
those constant,
wow,
footsteps.
That's really interesting.
And it's why it has these refrains, like little choruses,
yeah,
throughout, because it's easy to kind of recall. It is definitely a poem meant to be read aloud, I think, in those terms. I always actually think about this opening almost filmically, partially because I'm a film media teacher.
Yeah, yeah.
But many films have been made on this topic, and I imagine if I was to actually screen or shoot this particular opening charge,
yeah,
I wouldn't show one super quick shot, one super quick clip of them charging before hitting the enemy. I would build up that tension.
Yeah.
I would show them kind of at a distance, maybe a quick close-up of some hooves
hitting, yeah,
then a wider shot of them kind of moving these mile upon mile towards the enemy, and then again. And I think it does have that same effect here. That,
yeah,
repetition makes it very strong rhythm and does build that tension of an anticipation,
definitely,
of the fight to actually come. So then as we move through first paragraph, we've got that first reference to the Valley of Death, all in the Valley of Death, which, as we've already said, is a reference to the Lord's Prayer particularly. So not only is it that strong imagery and shows them actually against impossible odds, but also has that resonance of that they're on almost maybe a divine kind of mission. They have,
yes,
God on their side. Then we've got that reference we've already discussed in regards to the orders given, forward the Light Brigade, charge for the guns, he said. And then, again, the one thing we've already discussed, the final two lines, which is almost repeated throughout the poem, into the Valley of Death rode the 600.
Yeah. Well, so then we've got in the third stanza, we've got the kind of the confusion,
mm-hmm,
the cannon to the right, cannon to the left, cannon in front, you know, again we've got that strong, we've had the, that first word is repeated on every line, and that happens pretty much throughout at some point, where we've got the real focus of this stanza being introduced, and it just really emphasizes the fact that they were completely surrounded. They didn't have a chance. You know, you can think of cannons, these, you know, really strong war, you know, artillery. And they're completely surrounded by them. You know, it was a strategic nightmare. And we've got here volley and thundered. Again, it's just this sound that that's being created,
absolutely,
when you read this out loud.
And the following line, stormed at with shot and shell. You know, that's fairly alliterative, and those verbs really showing that sounds of battle. Volleyed, thundered, stormed, shot,
yeah, the connotations
shell.
There are, you know, you could really explore for your AO2, your writer's methods. They're really strong. And then again, we've got jaws of death, mouth of hell, wrote the 600.
Talking about identifying those methods, what's the name for that repetition of the S sound?
Sibilance.
Yeah, sibilance, absolutely. We need to be very, very specific about those references that we're using, and because we know that use of that technical vocabulary is really key to,
I think, in
marks.
Particular, where we've got that war, when we have a war poem, we've got the use of sibilance, and
yeah,
we've got that sound then of, like, the, you know, it's I can't remember which other poem it is, but it sounds like there are bullets actually sort of flying past. I think it might be Exposure or maybe Bayonet Charge.
So stanza four, flashed all their sabres bare, now their sabres are their swords. We know this is the light brigade, light referring to the fact they're lightly armed. The idea is they're supposed to go in quickly, cause maximum damage and get out of there quickly. And of course that's what went wrong. They attacked a Russian force that could pin them down and cause mass casualties. But they're flashing these sabres and they're flashing as they turn in the air. Again, this kind of glamorous image of these fine,
super fast, you know, you can picture like the best sort of battle scene, you know, where you've got these, you know, swordsmen that are extremely skilled and moving very quickly through.
Well, I think there is a vulnerability there. Flash their sabres bare. We know that they are using swords against cannons. There is this implicit kind of irony there that actually, despite the excellent swordsmanship and the damage they can cause, they are again against kind of impossible odds.
No, it's David and Goliath, isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely.
Plunged into the battery smoke. Again, these verbs, they're not showing any control for these soldiers. Shattered and sundered. I mean, it's again, we've got that sibilance. We've got that real sort of imagery there of what's going on and how brutally they are being destroyed.
And then that stanza four, concludes with a break from the pattern. Previously, the previous three stanzas have been into the valley of death, into the mouth of hell, rode the 600. And here we have that turning point of the poem. Then they rode back, but not the 600. And it includes that double repetition of not. That
I love that bit. That's the other part that gives me shivers, I think.
Absolutely.
That final line of the stanza, not the 600, where we've had the story, we've had it be told, you know, and we've got that reference to the 600, almost reassuring the reader for stanzas 1, 2, and 3. And then, you know, the final three stanzas are sort of post battle and the retreat, and it's, you know, it's sad. It's meant to be sad. It's meant to be poignant.
Absolutely.
It's meant to, you know, poignant is if something sort of stays with you, and I think that line definitely does.
I think you're right. I mean, like you said, throughout we've had this reinforcement, this security of this 600 as a unit.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the first time that's broken apart. And we do get the sense that, yes, despite this incredible charge, despite the Cossack and Russian reeling from their sabre strokes, this has come at a serious cost.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have a repetition of cannon to the right of them, cannon to the left, cannon behind, that we had in stanza three, showing them almost on their way out.
Yeah.
They've gone in, they've had their attack, they're now having to get out of there, but they're still suffering those casualties. They're still surrounded. We still have the volleyed and thundered and stormed out with shot and shell. And now an explicit reference to the deaths taking place while horse and hero fell.
Yeah.
And of course the word hero.
Yeah, the connotations there, you know, you're on the side of the soldier here. You know, they have done their best. There is nothing, there is no critique here of a soldier whatsoever. You know, hero is such an emotive noun. You know, it has, you think of Hercules and people trying to do the impossible, and they just haven't been able to this time.
And at the same time, it's euphemistic.
Yeah.
They fell.
Yeah.
And they not died, not suffered, not descriptions of the injuries like you might get in a few poems, but rather these are heroes fallen. So they're dying a warrior death. There's still this kind of glorification of this picture and of the individuals and of the fight itself. And then they came back through the jaws of death. And again, this is actually, again, reminiscent of stanza three, the jaws of death being a kind of personification.
Yeah.
Giving this kind of notion of a predator out to get them. Not something death, something that's just happening, but death coming to get them.
Well, we've got that with the mouth of hell as well. You know, the jaws and mouth, it's vicious. It's, you think of a shark attack, you know. The imagery there from the personification is huge and very frightening.
Absolutely. And then we come to the final, again, two lines, again, reminiscent of those preceding, but this time all that was left of 600. Just like stanza four had a repetition of not, we've got repetition of left here, all that is left, showing again the scale of that tragedy without being specific, but again, giving us this kind of rather underpinning feeling of tragedy.
Yeah. And the last stanza then, so this is sort of...
I like to think of it as an epilogue.
Do you know what? Because it's shorter as well.
It is.
So structurally, we can see that. I was saying earlier how the six stanzas, this had blown my mind when Mr. Neil said this, but that the six stanzas might be representative each of the 600. And there's that last stanza is so few, mm-hmm. perhaps, that are returning. When can their glory fade? We've got a rhetorical question there. The reader... there isn't an answer. The answer is never. Mm-hmm. You know, they've done this deed and they will always be remembered.
I think I link to poppies on that. Poppies are, of course, the thing that we wear on Remembrance Day to remember those who have fallen in all wars, primarily World War One, simply because that's where the symbolism
came from.
But actually in all wars. I think this poem itself is actually meant to be the symbol of this particular battle, the thing that is remembered. And I think it knows it. I think Tennyson, when he wrote this, meant it to be an honorific. He meant it to be something that was written in honour of those that had fallen.
Well, he's done his job.
Absolutely.
You know, we're still talking about it. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't a poem that was written 2 years ago. It was written in 1854. So it's really quite remarkable that we're still talking about this battle. Mm-hmm. So it is successful in what he's done. And it is important that you consider the poet's intentions, really, behind what they're doing, because you can link a lot of, you know, the fact that everything is so memorable, the fact that we've got that rhythm, it helps things stay in your mind. It helps you pass that message on. If you're going to go and tell someone about this poem, you can remember it much easier. And the messages, because of how significant and how much they stick to you with that repetition.
And he doesn't leave it to chance. Those final lines is an imperative. It's imperative language. It's an order.
Yes.
Honour the charge they made. Honour the Light Brigade. I said it was honorific, and really you can't get much clearer.
No.
It's the deliberate intention. The only one thing that we did skip across slightly was All the World Wondered, which appears twice in there. And I think that there is, I said there was two allusions to the mistake that was made. I've changed my mind. I think it's three. I think that line is there as well.
Okay,
because
perhaps.
That also has a bit of double meaning, a bit of double entendre. What it has is potentially a respect. They should all be admired. But also, secondly, you wonder sometimes at a mistake.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of double meaning there can hint at that the slight underlying, slightly hidden second meaning of this poem, the second thing you might draw from it, that is that subtle criticism of those in power.
And perhaps a lesson.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. Let's not let this happen again. Okay, I think we're just about done.
That was fantastic. Thank
you very much. I hope you enjoy and I hope this helps. Good luck, guys.